to the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, we bring you the recording of the 2015 Harold Mitchell Development Policy Annual Lecture, which was delivered by Professor Mari Pengestu. The topic was the new economy and development, an Indonesian perspective.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Your Excellencies, distinguished guests, friends of the ANU, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome you to this lecture, the 2015 Harold Mitchell Development Policy Annual Lecture. If we've not met, my name is Tom Compass. I'm the director of the Crawford School, and it's my great pleasure to have you in the school. And thank you all for coming. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the first Australians whose lands we meet on and pay respects to their elders past and present. Today's lecture is a third in the series. It's a lecture that is presented by the Development Policy Center here at the ANU in the Crawford School, something we're very proud of, and very proud of having Stephen lead that center. It's also in conjunction with two other units, in fact, in collaboration with the ANU Indonesia Project, which is in the Arndt Cordon Department of Economics here in the College of Asia and the Pacific, also part of the Crawford School, and the Australia-Indonesia Center. There's a huge core of expertise in this college, in this school, on Indonesia and development issues, and indeed on aid issues, and you're starting to see that here in this sort of collaboration. The lecture series itself is made possible by the generous support of one of Australia's best, one of Australia's most successful businessmen and philanthropist, Mr. Harold Mitchell, who's chairman of the Harold Mitchell Foundation. Harold, honor to have you back in the Crawford School here at ANU again, and very, very honored to have you as a friend of the Crawford School and DPC and all that we're doing. If you don't know, in 2012, Harold Mitchell made a very generous donation to the Development Policy Center here at ANU Crawford in CAP of $2.5 million. And since that time, the center has just been doing fantastic. It's dynamite, with a huge, huge list of achievements and a nice, I think, launch today, Stephen, is that right? Launch today a nice annual report to tell you all the wonderful things that they are doing. So I think everyone has a copy. If not, please grab one. Since 2013, Harold Mitchell has been chair of the Australia-Indonesia Center, which is part of the partnership in this event, which brings together Monash University of Melbourne as well as the ANU. So being chair of the Australia-Indonesia Center makes tonight's speaker especially appropriate to this event and this particular exercise. Indeed, before going to the main speaker, I'll ask the Vice Chancellor to introduce our main speaker, our speaker for tonight. Before doing that, though, I want to give Harold an opportunity to come up and say a few words. Please welcome Harold Mitchell.
Thank you very much, Tom, and good afternoon to all of you, ladies and gentlemen, of all ages, young and old, I'd say, but friends, I should say, of Australia and Indonesia. There could never be a more important time for us all to be here right now. But can I especially, Ibu Mari, welcome you for being here today, and just to say a couple of general things as to why I'm here in support of the Development Policy Centre, in support of the ANU and all of those involved. And can I also recognise Vice-Chancellor Ian Young? This might be our last time here together, but thank you so much for introducing us all in every way. To you, Tom, and to Professor Stephen Howes, who's such a brilliant mind, and I might say, in everything that you do, Stephen, great power to you in every way, and your other colleagues here today. So why am I standing here for a couple of minutes for a few words? It's this. The relationship between Australia and Indonesia is possibly one of the most important that we should have. As friends of Indonesia and Australia, you would probably know that, but let me give that just a little perspective, that it is one of our nearest neighbours, but it is such an important neighbour in such amazing ways. One of its location where it is, but the importance of us in this expanding Asia, which is going to be the greatest thing that has happened in this century. Asia will soon be 50% of the world's middle-class people, 50% of the world's economy, and together, Ibu Marie, we are in it, and we share all of that together. If we are friends, which we are, and if we are good friends, which we must be, together we will have incredible economies and country. Right now, Indonesia is the 17th biggest economy in the world. Australia is the 13th. Not bad, you'd say, for a country that's between 1% and 2% of the world's population. 10 years on, I can tell you this, and many of you will know, Indonesia will be the 7th biggest economy in the world and will be a close neighbour of us and a good friend. If we grasp all of that together, the world will be our oyster. And that's really what we're here today. I should say we'll be able to hear Ibu Marie in just a moment, but we met, less than a year ago in Jakarta when you were a minister, and I was unbelievably impressed, I should say, with the approach that you took to what is a modern world in an incredible way that we didn't understand enough. And I'm pleased to see that today you are embracing the subject which is of the modern world. And I can tell you this too, it was no surprise to me a little while ago as I looked and I ran a big communications business that we built on the cutting edge of the technology of the new digital age. I was pleased to find that in Jakarta they do things better than we do in Melbourne. How good is that? And Ibu Marie, you should be proud of what you've been doing and the way that you're headed and where your country is going. We wish you well in the future and consider us always good friends, and we look forward to hearing you today. Thank you.
Harold, thank you very much. Much appreciated. Friends, colleagues, also my great pleasure to introduce the Vice Chancellor of the ANU. Please welcome Professor Yin Yong.
Well, thank you, Tom. Today it's my very great pleasure to welcome back to ANU Professor Mari Pangestu, one of Indonesia's leading policy voices and intellectuals. Of course, Mari called ANU home for a number of years whilst she completed both her bachelor's and master's degrees, and we're delighted to count her as one of our finest alumni. So welcome back to ANU. In 1986, she completed her PhD following her time at ANU, but completed her PhD at the University of California, Davis, where she specialised in macroeconomics and international trade and finance. From 2004 to 2011, Professor Pangestu served as Indonesia's Minister for Trade, and from 2011 until October 2014 as Minister of Tourism and Creative Economy. In December of 2013, Mari Pangestu was awarded the degree of Doctors of Letters honoris causa from the ANU, recognising her outstanding contributions in the service of society. Over the course of her career, she has acquired vast knowledge in a whole range of areas, including academia, international organisations and government, working in areas related to international trade and investment in multilateral, regional and domestic settings. As Minister of Trade, she played an active role in the World Trade Organisation, initiating various Ministers of Trade meetings, providing leadership in regional cooperation at events such as ASEAN in 2011 and at APAC. Before becoming a minister, she provided policy advice on international trade and investment issues, political economy of reforms, and sustainable development issues. She's currently Professor of International Economics in the Faculty of Economics at the University of Indonesia and is on the board of directors of the Centre of Strategic and International Studies, one of Indonesia's leading think tanks. Today she will speak on Indonesia's new wave of economic change and the challenges, opportunities and policies ahead. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming back to the university to deliver the 2015 Harold Mitchell Lecture, Professor Mari Pangestu.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Yin Yang, for your kind introduction. Mr. Harold Mitchell, Professor Tom Kompas, Veronica Taylor and Stephen House, and also Ms. Stephanie Corpus-Campbell, Excellency Ambassador Najib and Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, and friends. I see a lot of students here. I'm greatly honored to be giving the 2015 Harold Mitchell Development Lecture. I have met Harold Mitchell before in person. He came to pay a visit to my office as chair of the Australia-Indonesia Center. And I was definitely impressed by you, Mr. Mitchell, as the media legend of Australia, and actually a businessman, a very successful businessman in the creative economy space of advertising and media. And since then, I have discovered that he's really someone who has given back in many ways, including to development issues, and obviously supporting the Australia-Indonesia Center. So I would say he's indeed a very rare person. And we're all grateful that I can be here to deliver the Harold Mitchell Lecture. Given the others who have spoken before me at this lecture series, I hope I can do justice to this lecture series. There's a lot that I wanted to say, so it was really difficult to really hone in on what I really should say that would be meaningful. So I decided that since this series is entitled Development Policy, I would like to share my experience in trying to implement policies to develop Indonesia. So it would not only come from an Indonesian perspective, one could say a very large and complex developing country, but I would also like to share my experience as an economist who, by accident, became a policymaker. And in fact, an economist who graduated from ANU. And frankly, I'm a little bit nervous because some of my ex-professors are in the room, so it feels a little bit like being examined again. And in my 10 years in government, I was responsible for many things, including reforms in the trade area, and responding to crisis, setting up and restructuring bureaucracies and ministries with new mandates, including the creative economy. So I thought that I would talk somewhat on the creative economy, but also talk about how do you actually do reforms and how do you actually introduce new policies like the creative economy. And I would like to start, I was taught this by someone, I can't remember who, that I should start my talk always with the conclusion so that you know where I'm going. So the conclusion is, not surprisingly, maybe I'll never give up on this conclusion, that evidence-based policymaking and clear targeting is very important for sustainable development. I still believe in it, even though we have had hits and misses. But I do believe that whatever we do in policy making, we do have to have the underlying information analysis, learn from past experiences of other countries or even in our own country. And you know, how do you frame your policy? How do you evaluate your policies, whether they're on target or not? And the importance in a democracy of getting public ownership of whatever it is that you do. You know, that turns out to be the hardest thing to do. So this talk is kind of divided into two. I'll start with a very brief statement about Indonesia's development before I share with you six lessons in policy reforms and policy change for development in the case of Indonesia, both for structural reforms that we had to do, as well as responding to the new economy challenges or creating the creative economy as the illustration of how did we actually implement policy. So three, I believe that when you make policy or any government that's in government does need to be well informed on what's happening in the rest of the world. You don't live in isolation or autarky. If those economic students will know, autarky means you're not dealing with the rest of the world. So understanding the new normal and the new economy of the world, the external situation that your country is in, is crucial to making good policy. That's why I'm spending a little bit of time on it. And then once you do that, I would like to then ask the question, if we're talking about Indonesia's economic development moving on, we still have to continue the structural change and structural reforms and the change in the way we approach development moving on. How are we going to do that? And what are the six lessons in policy reform that informed us in the past and in present and hopefully in the future? So that's kind of what I'm going to try to do. So the new normal has become this language that people use post-global crisis, because things have in a way, fundamentally changed since 2009. So we are now 6 years down the road. We now have to actually find real sources of growth. There's no more easy money, quantitative easing. Well, Europe and Japan has quantitative easing, but it won't last that long, and we should not rely on it. The U.S. is going to withdraw its quantitative easing. Fiscal stimulus is no longer a source of growth, so you have to go back to basics, which is productivity-driven growth. Low commodity prices are here to stay. Indonesia, like Australia, is dependent or has a large share of its exports and the structure of their economy based on commodity-based exports. 65% of our exports are commodity-based. So we have to switch, we have to diversify again. This is not the first time Indonesia is asking these questions, probably also for Australia the same thing. China slowing down and structural reforms that China is going. So China is going to a new normal, which is lower growth and leaving somewhat the space of labor-intensive exports. Is that a space that Indonesia should enter? And they are going into services and innovation. Again, beware, you know, this is competition. The way you do trade has fundamentally changed a lot because of technology, because of liberalization, because of regional agreements. And, you know, in the old days when I took economics and we learned about production networks, it was like graduation. You graduate from the low end to the medium end to the higher end, you graduate. And it was a sequential thing. But and the production is fragmented by product. But now it's the global value chain where the fragmentation is even more finer and it's based on tasks rather than on products. And as tariffs come down, non-tariff barriers are what will come out. And standards will become the big issue, whatever, whether it's environmental standards, whether it's technical standards, technology standards, and so on. So you have to meet these standards. The type of goods and services demanded and supplied will be affected by demography. We have aging Northeast Asia and a bonus in Southeast Asia and a demographic bonus in Southeast Asia and India. Younger population, which will not get older until about 2025, 2030. And middle class. The growth pole is shifting to Asia. 40% of growth in the world now apparently is coming from emerging economies, and we happen to be in a good neighborhood. Urbanization will continue to increase. This means smart, creative, and livable cities. This is just outlining to you what is the situation of the world that we are facing. And it's a opportunity, but also the way you must drive your competitiveness and your productivity is going to change. And this comes from a lot of the economic literature. This is actually from Hausmann, if for those of you from the economics profession. And it is really telling the story of how things have just become more fragmented. And therefore, for you to be competitive, you are going to be more competitive and less vulnerable to shocks like commodity prices going down, the more diversified your economy is. And the more diversified your economy is no longer just based on, you know, how many on natural resources or on labor and the endowments of your country, but it is really about capabilities, skills, technology, and so on. Products that need more capabilities will be made by fewer countries, and products will become just, it's just difficult to know what is a product or service anymore. Countries with richer set of capabilities will be able to produce more innovative products. So diversification at all levels is very important. And this is really getting into the creative economy and the new economy. Give you some examples. I could give you many, many examples. This is a Boeing jet, I think, and it's showing you who's making what where and how it gets exchanged. Indonesia is not in there, but actually Indonesia does make, I believe, some part of the wing down there is being made in Indonesia at IPTN, which was, as Indonesians will know, this was an aircraft company that existed 30 years ago as part of the strategic targeting, industrial targeting, strategic targeting. Okay, they did make some small planes, but now they're making, they're doing a lot of maintenance, they're doing a lot of parts of the plane because they have, what is it called, an off-taker relationship with Boeing. And the design is being done somewhere. Yeah, this is you're just talking about the manufacturing, but the design is being done somewhere. This is the example of the global, one of the examples often used in global value chain. When you look at China exporting iPods to USA in 2009, this is for 10 iPods. It looks like China is exporting $1,875 worth for 10 iPods. One iPod is $187. And they're importing $229 in inputs from the US. But they're actually only, the value added in China is only $65 because China is using inputs from Taiwan, Germany, Korea, and the rest of the world. So the value added is really only 3.4%. And if you look at the retail price of iPod, which is $187, most of the value is being enjoyed by the US for the creative design and the IPR of an iPod. An iPod is actually a perfect example of a creative product or creative industry, because the iPod was created not with any new technology. It was three technology platforms that already existed with very little value. It took a genius, a creative person called Steve Jobs, to look at it and create the iPod from these three technology and create a huge amount of value from it. That's an example of a perfect example of a creative economy. So the global value chain is very different from when I studied patterns of production network and flying geese, flying geese going from one country to the other. It's really more complex because of technology and the cost of access to resources and markets, as well as reform of trade policy. This is another example. This is a creative economy example. This is a real example that I got from one of our animation producers. In the value chain or production function, I suppose, of a producing an animation series, this is what it looks like. And the pre-production is really the IP. That's where you create the character. That's where Mickey Mouse gets created. And that's really the high end, and that's where the high value is. And that's the most difficult part. So most countries, again, it's kind of the way you progress. We started out with outsourcing of animation. And we are now getting into the post-production and editing, with already going into digital visual effects. But we started out with outsourcing. And next time you see any of these movies, part of it is being made in Indonesia. Next time you see Garfield, 50% of it is being made in Batam, in an animation studio in Batam. We haven't quite gotten to the pre-production stage. That's really the hard part. But Korea started out like we did, I would say, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, maybe 10 years ago. And so we hope to be going where Korea is going towards the pre-production stage, because that's where the value is. So in the context of value chain, we don't specialize in goods anymore, we specialize in tasks. It can be design, it can be graphic, it can be any part of the services or the inputs of the production. And please remember this is a very important lesson. When you export, there's a lot of import content in there. So if you want to increase your exports, your imports will increase, because you want to have the most competitive input, whether it's an input or a service, to make your export competitive. Because we have this debate going on in Indonesia right now, which is, and maybe not just in Indonesia, in other countries, which is a little bit anti-import. But if you want to be competitive, you can't really be anti-import. This is what this is saying. And you need an efficient services sector. So there's all kinds of things happening. ICT allows fragmentation. You have a lot of outsourcing and offshoring. The call center of many US and Japanese companies, where the labor is expensive, is being done somewhere in the world. So when you call AT&T in the US, it could be somebody in India answering your phone, or somebody in Philippines answering your phone in the customer service. And animation is a good example. Software is another good example where there's a lot of offshoring happening. This is the graph for how much export of computer services in selected developing economies have just gone up because of offshoring and so on. So this is the new economy. It's they have this terminology, technology disruption. So it was the railway and the steam engine in the past and the invention of mass production and so on. Today, it's really the Internet of Things, the cloud, and so on. And every time you have a technology disruption, you have new business models, new approach of political campaigns. We all know this in Indonesia. This social media has been a very important part of our democratic process, and new methods of social support targeting and so on. So destructive technologies is really about the mobile internet, the big data, the Internet of Things, automation, cloud, which can modernize sectors across the economy and drive major productivity improvements. But later on, you will see, it also brings inclusiveness and has a lot to contribute for development. And this is an estimate by McKinsey of the value, potential value from the new economy. Mobile internet is revolutionary. Those of you from Indonesia will know this. Mobile banking and mobile payments, social media, information, online selling, delivery of services, they're all being facilitated by the mobile telephone. And if you look at creative goods exports, the biggest component is design. Yeah, and this actually does include fashion as well in there. So what we want to be doing is not just exporting garments, we want to be exporting fashion with our own brand, hopefully. That's the trying to understand creative economy. So this is really the transformation that we're talking about. And it doesn't mean you go from one to the other. In Indonesia, you could say we have all this. But what we want to be doing is making our competitiveness and productivity growth really work, and we want to be approaching the creative economy and the new economy. Value added in the new economy and the global value chain world is about competitiveness, and it's about openness, it's about building your infrastructure, being able to access internationally competitive inputs and technology, and a conducive ecosystem. This is a word that is very much often used in the creative economy space, where you want to have the intellectual property right protection, you want to have the right kind of skills, you want to have access to financing and market and so on. And let's forget about this debate, or should we forget about this debate? I probably should put it as a rhetorical question. Right after the global crisis, there was a big debate about, because export orientation tended to, they thought, expose the vulnerability of a country to external shocks. So therefore, let's focus on domestic market. It's fine if your domestic market is big, but if your domestic market is not big, that's not a good idea. And even if your domestic market is big, it's really not about import substitution or export orientation. It's really about competitiveness, including being able to compete domestically. And then we have this whole debate about we have to process everything, we have to have value added for all our raw materials. Is that the one? Do we want downstreaming for the sake of downstreaming, or are we more interested in having value added that is sustainable? These are the debates we are having in Indonesia, as you know. And if we want to be competitive and have productivity-based growth, we do have to have openness. If you want to be part of the global value chain, you have to be able to input services and imported intermediate goods at the competitive price. So openness is important. You have to allow experts to be able to come and help you what you don't know, right? So movement of people is also important. You need infrastructure, you need logistics to be efficient. So structure reforms is important. Having a conducive ecosystem is very much needed for creative economy. In my conclusion, I will tell you what this comprises of. And does that mean if we do openness, if we do competitiveness and efficiency, we don't care about development? We don't care about the inclusiveness and equitable issues that are really also affecting a lot of policies? No, because I was taught by good professors, I think, about specificity of policy. If you have many targets, you have competitiveness target, you have inclusiveness target, you have poverty alleviation target, you can't use one policy. You need policies that are targeted for the objective. So you can have other policies for empowerment and inclusiveness. And you can even, if you think about it carefully, you can build or mainstream the issues of inclusiveness and empowerment within the policy framework that you are taking. And this is where we, later on, in when I talk about the policy reforms, I will try to give you illustration. I think this is the final slide before we talk about policy reforms, the experience of policy reforms. Now, as I said, when I learned economics and good policy, I learned about evidence-based policymaking. I learned about specificity of policy, but I was not taught how to deal with the political pressures or all the debates and discussion that go on. And we have to be realistic that nationalistic tendencies are everywhere, not just in Indonesia. And maybe this is where Harold is an expert, not me. How do you package all those messages about being openness, about being competitive, about being part of the global value chain? Otherwise, you are not going to be competitive and have development and be the seventh largest economy in 2 decades and so on. Maybe you should call it something else. Focus on human capital. We don't focus on sectors. We focus on wanting to have everything be made in Indonesia. Let's focus on human capital as the new national interest. This is just an example of packaging. We can think of many things. Governments are bad at picking winners. If we choose a sectoral industrial policy approach, even in the creative economy space, government are bad at picking winners, and losers are certainly good at picking the government. We know that. We can have industrial policy, but not on sectors or industry. Let's have it on the input side. Facilitation and incentives for R&D, for creative design, for training, etc., etc. This is just a suggestion. And I took this from some editorial, which I thought was very relevant. Never say the word free trade. I've learned that. I was 7 years as trade minister. So even though you don't say it in the words that really get people upset, you know, if that gets people upset. Generally speaking, we accept that international trade is better free than unfree, fair, not free, even if it is very problematic for leaders and government and ministers to say so. You know, this is getting into the political economy. Okay, let me now get into the political economy. So the conclusion from that very brief explanation that I gave you is that Indonesia needs to remain open. If it's going to grow, it needs to be open. If it's going to be part of the global value chain, to be able to be competitive and be responding to the new economy, they have to be open. That means they have to continue the structure reforms. And they have to address this new economy and the creative economy. Can they do that? What are the lessons in policy reform and introducing change that I can share with you from my 10 years of experience in government? 6 lessons in policy reform and change. And I will use examples from the trade area as well as from the creative economy area. Political commitment at the top. This is a no-brainer. I think everybody knows this. In every country, that's true. Before democracy, Hadi Susastro, the late Hadi Susastro, coined this term. It was low politics. All you had to do was convince President Suharto and everything is right. Top down, you know. In 1994, he had this famous statement, ready or not, whether you want it or not, we are going to globalize. And that was the year we hosted APEC. But today's, it should have been a minister in those days, much easier. In the last 10 years, since democracy, it's really much harder. Even if you had a political commitment at the top, which we did coming in 2004, we had a whole reform agenda, and we did implement most of it, but actually getting it accepted in parliament, by the wider public, and even after you pass the laws and regulations, making those reforms stick was not easy, and that there comes all the rest of the lessons. Second, bad times lead to good policies. As Winston Churchill said, never waste a good crisis. And Indonesia is very well known for that. I think many of us write on this a lot. Whenever it's good times, we tend to have bad policies or not so good policies. And when we have a crisis, we tend to have good policies. Like when the oil price fell in 1986, 80% of Indonesia's export was oil. And then we went through this deregulation reforms, including closing down the customs overnight, telling them to go home, and inviting SGS, very revolutionary policy at the time, inviting a Swiss surveying company to come in and do the customs function. But it worked. The exports went up. And by the 90s, you know, exports had gone down, of oil had gone down to 40% of our exports. Financial crisis in 98 and the last financial crisis in 2009, we also introduced a lot of reforms. And in 2013, we were labeled one of the fragile five emerging economies because we had capital outflow due to our deficit. So we also rolled back a number of the kind of protectionist policies. So this is just an example, and I would just like to add that during crisis, we learned a lot about managing crisis and the vulnerabilities that a country faces, the importance of social safety nets. So between 2005 and now, the Cash for Poor program, which was introduced in 2005 when we first raised the fuel price, it's by name and by address. This is getting into the main conclusion, which is the importance of facts and figures, targeting, and evidence-based policy. Evidence-based policy shows that cash for poor, direct cash transfers is the best way for a social safety net when you have a shock in your economy. How do you deliver it? You have to know who the poor are, so census, statistically by name, by address. How do you deliver it? We did it by the post office. But by now, it is being delivered through the banking system. So you learn progressively how to do it with new technology, with creative economy applications. Role of international commitments and benchmarks. Your WTO commitments, APEC in 94, your ASEAN commitments for the creative economy, knowing what does it mean to be a creative city, all the parameters that are in a creative city, helps cities to understand what the policies that are needed, like planning a creative public space, having a theater, having a museum, having a blueprint, having the education facilities for the particular creative field that you are trying to develop. This is part of the benchmark that you have. And drawing from international experience, but you need to be balanced because you don't want to be, politically speaking, you don't want to say, oh, we have to change this policy because the WTO tells us to do it. You know, the way you do it always has to be nuanced and balanced. In the pre-democratic period under Suharto, the technocrats used the international commitments quite a bit to get the reforms in place. International commitments can also prevent vested interest, such as the national car policy of Indonesia back in the 80s, when it was a blatant violation of the most favored nation principle, you know, allowing a Korean-made car to come in fully built, duty-free, compared to the Japanese and the Americans who had been there for many years, and not getting the same privileges. So we were taken to the WTO. That was our first experience with the WTO dispute settlement. We were taken to the WTO by the US, the EU, and we lost, of course, because we violated the most sacred principle. And despite that was a vested interest story, and despite the ministers, technocratic ministers, telling the people involved that, yeah, you can't do this, this is in violation of the most sacred principle, it still happened. But, you know, you go through the process and it didn't happen in the end. Fourth. Evidence-based policymaking. I really believe in this because I think it's the only way, because I was not taught how to deal with politicians or how to be political. The only thing that saved me was evidence-based policymaking, because that's the only way I could argue my way out or get my policies passed. When you change a law or you change a regulation, it's important to do what's called a regulatory impact analysis, and I think it might be have been coined by the Australian Productivity Commission. We studied a lot about how to do this, and we actually, a lot of my people in the Trade Ministry did undertake training with Australia on this. Framing the issue, making it clear, justifying the change for the change and the reform and the benefits, and packaging. and making it resonate. The role of media is very important here and other stakeholders. So like I said, I was very careful about never saying liberalization or free trade. I would always say fair trade, and I would always say, we need to create jobs. Never say, how you say it becomes very important. And putting numbers. Numbers really are very magical, it turns out. It's not because I'm an economist, but as soon as I was given the task of creative economy, it didn't make any sense to anybody until I put numbers to it. Same thing with tourism. People thought tourism was just a happy, happy thing. The moment you put numbers, you get a great job, you just go around jalan-jalan, going around. But hey, this is serious business. This is contributes so much to GDP, job creation, blah, blah, blah. You have to frame the issue very well. And I believe that my economics training and my evidence-based policy making experience helped a lot. Targeting is very important. Who's this policy for? And the design of policy based on targeting is very important. Learn from the industrial policy failures and lessons. I gave you already the example of the social safety net that we did. We do have the poor by name, by address. And we have a system, whether it's the post office or the banking system, that you can turn on and off very quickly. That's why as soon as there's a shock, it's very easy for us to turn on the system. I'll give you another example that I'm personally very proud of it. I was in charge of revitalization of traditional markets when I was a trade minister. And when I looked at the program, they were not getting very much. And it was like, okay, you get 100 billion rupiah, you divide it by X number of markets. So each market got something like 200 million rupiah. So this doesn't make sense. So one size fits all kind of policy. So I started going down to the field, blusukan, and I discovered a lot. I found that not every market is the same. There's some cultural differences. And what's important is that 90% or 95% of the people who work in the market are women. And the 90% are of the people who shop there are women. And you see them carrying their babies while they're selling their goods. And I still remember this experience. One day after the Jogja earthquake, I went down to the earthquake to Sleman where the earthquake happened. And in 4 o'clock in the morning, the market was already there on the ground, and they were all ladies. And so I said, how can you? Well, we have to live. How did you get the capital? Oh, we scraped whatever we could. So financing, microfinancing, especially for women, was important. So part of the design of the market now is gender sensitive because 90% of the people working there are women. So the toilets should be 90% for women. Not 50-50, right? And there has to be a lactation room. There has to be a child minding center. And it's not free, they pay. These are profit centers, by the way. The toilet and the child minding centers are profit centers. And it's auction, it's tendered. So this is, if you have to know what is the target that you're trying to do. I mean, I can tell you many more stories, but that's one. Maybe I'll give you one more gender example. When Sri Mulyani and I were ministers, she was finance and I was trade, and we had to come up with a cash for work program during the, I think it was the 2008, the 2009 crisis. And then all the programs that were coming out were like road building, all the men stuff, right? So we said, hey, women also need a cash for work program. So we redesigned the cash for work program so that it would also have a women employment. Okay, I'm running out of time. Let me just, another lesson, I'll have to run quickly through the creative economy story. Implementing reforms and making them stick in a democracy. Quick wins and islands of best practices. So, we are a very complex country, we're a very big country. You can't do the reform immediately across the country. So you have to pick within a particular policy certain parts that are easier to do. I'll give you an example. The finance ministry, when they did the tax reform, they started with the big taxpayers first. They created a big taxpayers office. And in my space, I identified the 77 or so import regulations and export regulations that were in place. We start putting them online and making them more transparent in phases. Yeah? And you need champions in government and local government and stakeholders for it to stick. Yeah? And champions in government could be the ministers in charge, and then you've got to convince the other ministers to support it. Local government is important, like the creative economy. When we came up with the blueprint in 2009, Bandung and West Java government also came up with the blueprint and identified creative economy potential for their region. They were the only region that did it. And guess what? The stakeholder that was the lead person there is now the mayor of Bandung. His name is Ridwan Kamil. He was one of the first to grab this idea. And so, you know, you can see this is the importance of having stakeholders in local government. Ownership of process, of the bureaucrats and the stakeholder. Because once you, as a minister, gone, they can just undo everything, right? So they have to believe in it. They have to be the one implementing it. Peer pressure with monitoring and targets. You know, we use the IFC cost of doing business, for instance, to monitor the reforms under the cost of under the investment climate. UNESCO has a lot of parameters for creative economy. Transparency and service level satisfaction. Once you do the reform, you've got to monitor: did that reform work or not? Did it affect the people that were supposed to be serviced or not? And Sri Mulyani did something which I thought was very revolutionary, and I did try to follow her footsteps. She, after the tax reform, after the bureaucratic reform, they were the first one to do the bureaucratic reform, the customs reform. She hired a third-party company, a private third company surveying company, to survey all the stakeholders that were serviced by the finance ministry, and got good marks for customs and tax. Guess where she got bad marks from? Internal government, budgetary process. All of them complain how long it took to disburse the budget and so on and so forth. So, you know, and then the last thing I would say is institutionalizing processes. Like, I give you rice as an example because it's kind of the hot issue now. We faced a political issue in 2006 with the import of rice. And as a result of the politicization of the issue, we were late in importing the rice and the price went up by 30% and poverty rate went up by 1%. So after that, learning that lesson, we institutionalize a process where if the price goes up by a certain amount and the stock in Bulog goes down by a certain amount, automatically the trade minister can issue an import license for Bulog, which is the state trading company that imports. So you depoliticize it. Unfortunately, I don't know what happened, but it should work, and you estimate the production to know how much import that you're going to have for that period. That's important because once the champions are gone, you want to continue the process. Okay, I wanted to use evidence-based policy making in the creative economy space as an example. We basically learned from the UK in terms of how to structure the creative economy. I mean, creative economy is really about how value can be created from existing knowledge and technology, including cultural heritage. So it's not just the cultural creative industries, but also the IT-based that we already talked about. The 15 sectors that we identified, we followed the UK example. And what was important was, in terms of what I learned about the importance of evidence-based policymaking, was actually this. Why are we doing creative economy? Besides doing all that explanation, if you don't put numbers to it, you don't put job creation to it, or you don't put the non-economic value to it, it doesn't make sense to people. So we actually did estimates of the economic contribution and how you find examples that resonate, and that this is something I had to learn as an economist also. Normally we just focus on the economic contribution, but the creation of value added, that's also economists understand that. But it's beyond that. It's branding and national identity, how Korea is a good example, how creative products have branded them. And it actually preserves your natural resources and your cultural resources by allowing traditional products to be contemporized and made modern and have a better market. You're actually preserving the culture. And then the social impact. And these are my numbers. I just go very quickly. And this is example of branding, how a nation branding comes from creative products. And here we go. This is just examples from Indonesia, how batik, tenun, everything has been modernized. And I usually bring a lot of show and tell. This is the only show and tell I brought today. This is a Louis Vuitton scarf. and it's being designed by Eko Nugroho, one of our famous contemporary artists. And he was selected by Louis Vuitton to do this. Yeah, and then this airport in Banyuwangi, another champion, a local champion for creative economy, designed by a famous architect using a traditional design. This is some examples from Indonesians that have gone global. I love this one because it's cultural heritage and IT. Okay, this guy started doing, was in the gaming world as doing outsourcing. Remember, I gave you the example of animation. He was doing gaming programs, blah, 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 for the Japanese. And then he said, I don't want to do it for the Japanese. I want to have an Indonesian game. So he did some research. He found that Indonesia is very culturally diverse, including the ghosts. So you only have vampire and whatever, ghosts. We have, every region has different ghosts. Okay? So he developed this game, which has Indonesian characteristic, and this game is sold out. And this is the different space of, you know, we think about going to trade exhibitions. If you want to make it in the gaming world, you have to be on this website called Steam. This is the website to be on to say that you've made it globally in the gaming world. And he's got about 9 million followers, and he raised money from crowdfunding. So even if 9 million players, if each player gave $1, you'd get 9 million. But not even you don't get 9 million players, just a very small percentage. You already got 25,000. Why would they give $1? Because they want to have more games coming up, right? So this is a different, totally different model. Many examples of that. Okay, my last slide, lessons in policy reform and change, coordination. Whole of government approach, whole of stakeholders, whole of society approach. And here evidence base is important to know who's doing what and making up the coordination mechanism, which is clear. And this is really the hard part because not one minister can do it. It has to be done by many. And when the governments change, it's the stakeholders who have to demand that the government continue the policy. That's why it's important for them to be part of it. And international partners. So this is actually after numerous focus discussion groups with 600 creative people from creative community. This is the summary of the blueprint and the action plan. So you have human resources, which is education, creative resources, growing the industry, and this is financing, access to markets, supporting infrastructure and technology and institutions. This is the ecosystem that must involve the education ministry, the finance ministry, the ICT ministry, the legal ministry because of the IPR issue, and so on, and the banking sector, the venture capitalists, and so on. I don't have time to go into it. We can explore it in the question and answer. And I want to illustrate to you, I'm sorry, can I take 5 more minutes? Because this is, I hope I know how to do this. I want to show you a film because I want to illustrate to you, can you?
Yeah,
illustrate to you the power of creative economy in reducing poverty and creating value. So that's an illustration. That was a good example of how you can increase your income from 8,000 rupiah to 20 million rupiah in one month. But it's not without, you know, value added. The theft went down. They don't know how to speak English. They used Google Translate. And it's actually 99 Designs is run by a young Australian. And 16% of their work is done by Indonesians. And they're self-taught, okay? And they knew where to go for help. They went to that design, the artist to learn. You know, they are not educated in graphic design. And the importance of basic infrastructure such as electricity and internet is important. The community was important. Social, less rural, urban migration of youth and less social issues such as unemployment, theft, and drinking. But it's not without challenges. Remember he said, don't need to go to school. You know, can become a billionaire without going to school. That's not a good message. I don't know how to deal with the issue of scaling up. You know, would you want to scale up these people? What happens if they start making more money? They don't do the farming anymore. They don't do this. And then what? You know, so these are some of the challenges. So I'll end on there. And the conclusion is still that I believe in evidence-based policymaking. And we have done this all throughout for the creative economy. And we have identified the issues that need to be addressed. And powerful examples like this is very important to make your case resonate. Thank you.
Thank you for a really fabulous address. It's a big audience. We have a little time for discussion. Those are meeting for the first time. I'm Rob Taylor. I'm Dean of our College of Asia and the Pacific. The way we'll structure this is that I'll recognise you and we will send you a microphone. We'll ask you just to identify yourself and then invite your question or your comment, provided that it's crisp and short. And that will enable us to share the time. So we'll have you first, sir.
Hi there, I'm Bosworth, I'm a visitor at the ACT.
I'm Malcolm.
Good to see you again, it's been a while, I'm looking forward to talking to you later. I enjoyed your presentation very much and would agree with what you said. I particularly noticed you mentioned the role of international commitments, you mentioned the WTO, and of course I agree they can be important, but it presupposes, I guess, the WTO is going to be able to stay useful. The problem, you also mentioned the sacred principle of MFN regarding the violation of Indonesia on the car plan many years ago. Seems to be the problem facing the WTO at the moment is that everybody's walking away from the MFN principle within the WTO, the sacred principle as you called it, and they're all doing it through these PTAs. Australia's doing it, Indonesia doing it, and Australian Minister, I'm sure you negotiated a few of them. My question to you is, how can the WTO possibly survive with everybody running off now willy-nilly and breaking this sacred MFN? And if you look at the collapse of the Doha round, clearly it shows that the WTO is really, really struggling in deep trouble. So how do we resurrect the WTO? Thank you.
We might take a couple of questions.
Okay, good idea.
And then invite you to respond to them. Thank you for that. Have you in the middle? Sure.
My name is I'm from Redneck. My question is, this is for Joseph Schumpeter, gold model, if I may be wrong, in macroeconomics. And part of the, what is the percentage of GDP on the total GDP from the creative economy? And also, what is the labor force percentage, and what is the outcome of the GDP budget? And also, that right now, I think growth strategy is doing in Thailand, India, and Korea. And what is the next step for your growth strategy?
The next step in growth strategy. Thanks, over here.
Hi, my name is Irene Wayne. My question is about how you said that bad times can lead to good policies, and you spoke a little bit about direct cash transfer programs, and the petrol subsidies policy has just been scrapped, and I wonder if you might talk a little bit about what you might see as some of the good policies that could be able to come in, you know, having all this room in the budget now, what you think might be happening next on that. Mm.
Okay. Thanks very much. We'll take those three and invite Dr. Pankhurst to respond.
I'm not sure I can answer your question, Malcolm, how to rescue the WTO. That would take another lecture. But I think basically, despite all that's happened, I do still have some optimism that, you know, whatever it is, the WTO, we know, has a lot of issues, but it's still the only governance on multilateral trade that we have. And, you know, despite the weaknesses in the dispute settlement, I guess it's still the only avenue for small countries like Indonesia to deal with the US or any of these other big guys whenever we're facing an unfair trade issue. And I mean, in the last part of my term as a trade minister, we did win a case against the US on clove cigarettes, which was MFA violation of, it was discrimination actually, and it was one of those principles too that we fought for. So how to reconcile it with preferential trade agreements? I guess I still believe that if we can design preferential trade agreements in the way that it's, you know, the bicycle theory and the building blocks theory, then we can still have the outcome of multilateralizing it at some point. You know, that's taking the positive view. I'm not saying that it's not without its challenges in terms of whether any of these agreements will really be able to be multilateralized and not just be preferential. Second, economic contribution. I have it here on. Oh, how do I? Okay. This was one of the things when I was first given the task of developing the creative economy. I started doing a bit of research and I found that there was this term actually, creative economy. Sometimes it's called cultural industry, sometimes it's called intellectual property industries and whatever, but there is this terminology, creative economy. And I remember one of the first presentations we did in 2007 when we started saying, oh, this is important, this is good for Indonesia. And then somebody in the room, it was actually Joop Ave, I don't know, you know, you guys know who Joop Ave is. He was the father of tourism, a very eloquent gentleman. He said, he raised his hand, he said, Mary, you're an economist. Tell me, how important is the creative economy? I said, it's important because, blah, blah. No, I want to know how important, numerically. So I said, oh, I don't have the numbers yet. Give me time. So we went to the Central Bureau of Statistics. We sat down with them. We started disaggregating the national income accounts, making some proxies, making estimates, blah, 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 which is exactly what the UK did in the beginning before they went out and did primary surveys on the sectors. And we came up with an estimate, not perfect, but it's an estimate of 7%. And when we come up with this number, people say, oh, yeah, okay, this is important. And this is important to go to Bappenas. I know there's somebody here from Bappenas. Say, we are an important sector. We need budget. We need support. Labor absorption, 10.7%. Number of companies, 9.6%. Exports is about 10%. So Thailand, Malaysia also have similar numbers. Thailand and Malaysia and Singapore focus only on 4 or 5 sectors. Indonesia, we are ambitious. We focus on 15 sectors because we think we have the cultural resources as well as the potential for the new economy in the IT space, just because of the market and the demographic bonus that we have. And the way forward is really we've identified. This was maybe a 2-year process. This is where I want to emphasize my conclusion about the importance of evidence-based and research and involving stakeholders. I learned a lot in the last 3 years about who are the creative people in Indonesia. And in fact, when you talk about institutionalization, it's not about creating a building or creating an organization. I told the creative people, I said, you have to organize yourself. I can't talk to you individually. And they were allergic. Believe me, they were allergic to that view that you have to organize yourself. I said, if you don't organize yourself, I don't know what your issues are, and I cannot help you. And I don't know how to facilitate you. I can't. I don't know what my target is. You know, you have to create yourself. So as a result, the film people, the animation people, they all now have, they don't want to be called asociasi or association, they want to be called community. You have creative communities everywhere and they select one of them democratically as a representative to deal with us. And they were the ones involved in the focus discussion groups. We had, I can't count how many meetings we had. We had numerous meetings. And we told them, you have to tell us what your issues are. Identify for us what your value chain looks like. Where are the weaknesses? What are the policies you want changed? What are the programs you want? What are the priorities? So this is came out of that exercise. So the idea is that we came up with a coordination mechanism between the industries, between the ministries and the local government to address these 7 strategic issues. And every sector will have a slightly different issue that they face. And hopefully the new government will take this blueprint and act upon it. Bad times lead to good policies. I hope that in the forthcoming period in by the new government, I think we did a lot of learning with the social safety net and cash transfer program, and even with the fuel subsidy. Yeah, I think there are programs now, whether it's the health or education or the cash transfer, and it was possible to do it quickly because of all that learning that we started in 2005. And there is a policy unit under the Vice President's office, which really just looks at poverty and poverty alleviation programs. So as I was saying earlier, this is important because whenever you have a shock or whenever you want to do something, you can turn on or off very quickly. And that's an ability that not a lot of countries have, but you know, we learn a lot. I think what we would hope is that it would go towards, everything would go e-government and e-program, where you would only have one card, a single identity number, and in that number it tells you you're eligible for this health program, for this education program, for this poverty alleviation program. That's kind of the ideal way to go, but we had some problems, as you know, with the single identity number project, but hopefully it can still be rescued. And it's linked now to you having a bank account, so it's part of the, it addresses financial inclusion as well, making the poor bankable.
Thank you, Umar. It's always stimulating to listen to your lectures. Just one simple question. The six lessons and the approach, they are great. Do you see them being used by the new government or even institutionalized? I'm sorry.
You shouldn't ask me that, Sadi. I think you know the answer, but basically... And this is where, that's why I kept on mentioning that it's important to involve the ownership of all these changes and reforms needs to involve not just the government, but the stakeholders outside. So if the government doesn't do it, or is late in doing it, or is not comprehensive in doing it, or is doing the wrong thing, then you've got to have informed stakeholders to be the one that will put pressure on the government. To do the right things, and that's why evidence-based policy making means to me also in the non-government domain. They also, whenever you want to criticize the government for whatever policy, you got to come up with the analysis of the facts and the figures. It may not resonate, it may not go anywhere, but at least you will have, the public should know about it, and the media, you know. I actually spent a lot of time in the last 3 years educating the media on the creative economy, and I achieved one target. You know, Compass, our leading newspaper, you know, they didn't know where to put the creative economy issue. Sometimes we got put under culture, sometimes we got put under education, sometimes we put under entertainment, sometimes we got put under economy. So I basically harassed them, and they're all my friends. So I harassed them, I give them all this information and the numbers and the analysis. And finally, now you can read Compass. We do have Economy Creative as a rubric, yeah, as a title that clearly puts you in there. And they quote all our numbers, and they quote all the issues, and they do a lot of examples like that designer kampung, because that's what needs to happen, you know, for people to understand what is this creative economy. So let's be optimistic that evidence-based policy. Better targeting, good policy can still be a debate outside of the government if the government doesn't do it.
There's much more to discuss. I know that there are many more questions, so I'm going to invite you to continue the conversation over refreshments in a moment. And to hold your applause, and I'll invite the Professor Sidney to a formal close and formal thank
you. Thank you, Veronica. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my honour to close proceedings this evening. I know I stand between you and drinks, so I'll be short. But thank you all for coming. Not only have we filled the lecture theatre, but we're live streaming, so this is being watched all around the world, and it's great to see such interest in these topics. May I thank our co-hosts, the Indonesia Project, which celebrates its 50th year this year, and 50th birthday, and the new Australia-Indonesia Centre. So thank my esteemed colleagues, Tom, Veronica, Ian, for all your support and encouragement. May I have my personal thanks to Harold Mitchell and, of course, to Stephanie, who runs the Harold Mitchell Foundation. And none of what we do would be possible without your support. And finally, most importantly, our thanks to our speaker, Professor Mari Pangestu. Ibu Mari, you are such a good advertisement for the ANU and for the economics profession. You've just delivered our third Harold Mitchell Development Policy Lecture. You've given a very forward-looking, challenging talk, or I think actually more than one talk, both about what good policy should look like and about how to get there. You've maintained, if not exceeded, the very high standards set by the first two lecturers in this series, so thank you so much. As I mentioned, ladies and gentlemen, please do stay for a drink outside, just downstairs. And if you haven't already, please do pick up a copy of our annual report for last year that we're releasing today. But first, join me, please, in thanking Professor Mari Pangestu.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.